Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this February 13th, Saturday, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. I just kind of threw the rhythm off there.
Yeah, it was very confusing.
This is Friday the 13th this month, falls on a Saturday.
Right.
And we have to keep that in mind.
Yes.
So today is Friday the 13th. It fell on a Saturday.
It makes it even a stranger Friday the 13th than normal.
Yeah, it's a Friday, Saturday the 13th.
Right.
Or a Saturday, Friday the 13th.
Or something.
Yes.
Yes.
And so today, ladies and gentlemen, is Friday the 13th. It fell on a Saturday in February of 2016. And if that's where it is, when it is, how it is, where you are, then you can give us a call in here at 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And I can see people zigzagging down the highway now trying to understand what the date is after me saying all of that.
The date is...
Wait a minute. Saturday, February 13th.
2016.
Which
yes.
is...
All day.
For some reason, very difficult for me to say. Saturday, February... The 13th in 26. It's just difficult. I don't know. All those teens.
I think this may be a symptom of something.
It is. It's a symptom of the fact that most of my life it was 19 something.
Yes. You are. It's a symptom of being born in the wrong millennia. Millennium?
The wrong half of the wrong millennium. Millennia. Millennium. Millennia is
it's
plural.
Millennium. Yes.
Millennia is plural, so millennium is singular. Yeah, I was actually born in the first half of the 20th millennium.
No.
20th, yes.
20th century.
No, 20th millennium. No, yeah, now you're right.
Another symptom, maybe more symptoms of being born a long time ago.
Well, actually, you got to understand this. When you spend as long as I did saying teen number, okay? And the number wasn't a teen. And then all of a sudden, we're given 1 year of transition. And then we're given 10 years, and then we run into this problem. And the problem is that
so what you're saying is
the teen now comes at the other end of the number,
right? So it takes you 16 years, and you're still not used to saying the century you're in.
Got it.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Can't teach an old dog how to say 20.
Anyway. We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, guys. There was an article in the Dallas Morning News about is the recession over and all that. Recently, the government was touting unemployment under 5%, which is
right.
good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The article mentioned a measure of unemployment, U6. I'm familiar with the different money supply terms, M1, M2, but I've never heard or thought that there was different levels of calculated unemployment. Can you enlighten us, please?
Sure. In the unemployment office, when people come in and sign up, the person sitting behind the
you
desk
sign up for, in the
says,
unemployment office?
Yes, the person behind
Are
the desk
sick?
Says, U6, come over here. No, no that's no. not what it is. Not at all. U6.
I think that's probably the way they determine it.
U6 is the measurement that includes people that used to have a job that aren't looking anymore.
Yes, it's what happened is, and it's really, really hard to figure out what all these extra unemployment numbers mean. Because
it takes someone fully employed doing just this to understand the unemployed figures.
But even if you understand the unemployed figures, they don't have any meaning because we don't have historic data on that.
Right.
It's
a relatively new measurement.
Very recently that Congress mandated that the Labor Department measure unemployment to get a higher number. And the reason was there weren't enough people unemployed to make, when they put this in the budget, to make the out of the party, let's not name them, the party that is that does not have control of the White House, happy with the unemployment numbers. Because obviously, if you have a really bad president for 7 years, unemployment should go up.
Except in this case,
it's gone down.
And what, this is something that we've covered this
before.
Not
that the president has any control over it whatsoever.
Exactly. We've covered this before. It doesn't matter what the president is doing. The president doesn't hire for private employers. So,
well, wait a minute now.
It's really nice to be able to blame things on the president or give the president credit, depending on which party you are in at, mm-hmm, the, mm-hmm, at the moment. If it's a, if it's your party president, you can give them credit for the economy. And if it's not, you can give them the blame for the economy and vice versa.
Right.
But the reality is that just like turning the Titanic, the economy can be influenced by a president, but it's usually well after their term of office is done. Mm-hmm. The changes that they make take a long time to influence because the president doesn't really have the power to change the economy. Congress does. And the president often will take credit for what Congress is doing and so on, back and forth. And Congress likes to blame the president for what they've done as well. And it doesn't matter what party you're in. They've been doing this since the beginning.
Well, they also like to blame the president for what the Congress has done.
So back to U6. What U6 does is it takes a number and it says, all right, at some point, this group of people was employed. They may or may not have tried to get another job after they became unemployed, but at some point they stopped looking. The reason why this measure is very, very difficult to understand is because it doesn't know what to do with retirees. And there are a lot of baby boomers that are hitting their retiree moment right now. So if it's, you know, 2 years before you retire, you have a spouse that's fully employed, and you get laid off from a job, you take unemployment while you're looking around, but you're not looking around really hard because you only want a job for a couple of years. And at some point, you stop looking. Well, that's what is being measured by U6. Okay. There's also groups of people that are measured in several of the other unemployment numbers that are less employed than they used to be, half-time or non-full-time work when they used to be full-time. Those numbers look better. The unemployment numbers look better. Even the U6 number looks better, but it's still a large number compared to the unemployment number.
Actually, you have U3, which is the official unemployment rate.
Right.
I don't know what U1 and U2 are. They're out there somewhere. U5, they skip U4.
Right.
Includes discouraged workers. That means people who are working, but they're discouraged. No,
yes.
No.
So everyone working at the post office.
Now,
no, that's disgruntled. Sorry.
Yeah, U5 includes... Now, what a discouraged worker is somebody who theoretically wants a job, but is given up looking for a job.
Right.
And I want you to think about, how do they read their minds?
Yes.
I don't know.
This is a number that the Labor Department somehow grabs out of people's brains.
Right, they do the household survey.
They do, and they show up, and they call, and they say, so, how are you feeling about the employment that you have at the moment?
That you don't have.
That you don't have and you wish you had.
But you're not looking for a job.
Right.
That's discouraged.
So, you have a job or you don't, but if you have a job and you don't like it and you would rather have another job.
No, that doesn't count.
That's
employed.
That's a different number.
That's probably U1 or U4.
Right.
Or something.
That's a number that has to do with not as fully employed as they want to be.
The U5 includes discouraged workers and other marginally attached workers. Now, that's a boy. U6 adds to that people who are only working part-time for economic reasons. Now, here's the problem. That would include, and there's, go to Lowe's,
yeah,
and you see people who are working part-time, older gentlemen mainly, some women, but mostly men, who are working in the hardware store part-time to supplement their retirements.
Yeah. They are, by definition, discouraged workers, even though they look pretty happy.
No. Discouraged workers.
Well, this is U6 number. I'm sorry, not discouraged.
A discouraged worker is a person who wants to work, who doesn't have a job,
right,
but has given up looking for work.
Right.
He theoretically would like to work, but he's not looking for a job.
Right.
I want you to think about that one for a little while, and only... I think the Bureau of Economic Analysis ought to handle that, because it's only bureaucrats could understand that.
That sounds like what everybody... I live in Austin. Everybody that holds the cardboard signs in Austin basically count as discouraged workers, even though they're not looking for work.
Yeah.
That, oh, okay. I wish I could have a job right now.
Can't find. Anyway, so the problem again with all these U numbers is that we don't have long-term historic data on them.
Yeah. So that,
which means we don't, we can't compare what these arbitrary numbers that have been come up with, that have come up because of some formula that's generated by Congress, by the way, for political purposes.
Right.
We don't know what that means, because we can't look back at previous recessions or recessions and say...
The good news is that we are getting the data now, and in the future we may be able to look back at it. But if we change how we look at these numbers and change how we measure them, it's out the window again.
Yeah, and that's just it. Since Congress... Let me tell you what I think is probably going to happen. The reason, by the way, you have the U's that are skipped is because in the process of funding things in the House of Representatives, they banned certain measures and they mandated certain other measures and they defined them. So once, let me give you an example. Let's say we elect a Republican.
Uh-huh.
And the House is still controlled by Republicans. They will then meet, probably, I'm not saying this is a certainty, they'll go back and change all of that again to make the current president look better.
Right. And then the next time the Democrats are in control and the Republicans are in the White House,
they'll change some it back
changes.
Again.
And
right.
That, it's a normal shift and turn when, let me tell you a little bit about how absurd it is. Because no other country in the world measures unemployment that way. No, you know, we've got a pretty standard unemployment.
No other country in the world has a House of Representatives.
Not like ours, anyway. But if you measured unemployment using the U6 number in Spain, mm-hmm. at the height of the recession,
there would be nobody employed.
There was an 80% unemployment rate.
Actually,
which doesn't make any sense, because their economy didn't so destroy itself. If you had measured during the Great Depression, our unemployment rate using U6 numbers would have been somewhere around the 80% number too, and that doesn't make sense. It was 30%, which is reasonable. 80% is not.
Well, this is an interesting thing in Spain. If you went to measure the unemployment rates in Spain,
uh-huh.
or for that matter in Venezuela or Russia,
right.
you'd have this little difficulty in that a very significant portion of government workers.
Yes.
aren't being paid.
How do you measure them?
So,
by definition, now that would be discouraged, but not by the definition set by the House of Representatives.
They're employed, they're just not being paid.
Right. That's more disgruntled than discouraged, I think, again.
Why do they continue to work for the government? Because they get benefits.
Right.
And they get the promise of retirement. By the way, this is one of the most fascinating things about government workers in Greece, in Russia, and in Spain. That's probably true in other places, too. Many of them are not getting paid anything right now.
Correct.
But when they retire, when they qualify for retirement at a certain number of years, they start getting paid.
Yes.
All they have to do is work for nothing long enough.
And they can do nothing for
pay. And then they can do nothing and get paid for the rest of their lives.
So they do something and get nothing so that they can do nothing and get something.
Yes.
Right.
I think should be able to do a dissertation, a PhD dissertation in economics on the logic of doing something to get nothing so that you can do nothing to get something.
Right. And when we talk about unemployment numbers, part of the reason why we don't use some of the numbers provided by the Labor Department is that they don't have any bearing on reality, really. There's political numbers and there's real numbers, and even the real numbers have a lot of wiggle room. So unemployment numbers come through a multitude of different methods. The numbers that are used by the government to say these are the number of people employed is different than, for instance, ADP is the biggest private payroll company out there. They do the payroll for many, 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 many corporations and small businesses and so on. And they come out pretty regularly with an employment number in the private market based on just the number of people getting paid in their system that is absolutely accurate. Now, it doesn't count people that are outside their system. It just says this is what we saw in our system, and these are real numbers. The Labor Department uses estimates, which is really funny because they should be able to real-time do exactly what ADP is doing and say this is the number of Social Security numbers that got their payroll taxes sent to us this month or this
given day.
But yeah. They can't do it.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Why is that? Because they're the government.
Well, you run into this problem in that small businesses, in many cases, only send it in quarterly.
Right. Well, so then you could at least have quarterly numbers that aren't estimates. But the Labor Department doesn't do that. Instead, they rely on other numbers to get this data. And ADP, for instance, uses the actual computerized data of who got paid and how many new employees got added into the system or employees got fired out of the system.
But theirs is also just an estimate because they are only measuring
their own
people who got paid through ADP.
Right. They don't estimate the rest. They say just our numbers say this, and it's a pretty good figure. It's a number that we can look at and say this doesn't include the whole economy. It doesn't include government workers at all. And it only includes part of the private workforce.
But sometimes they show employment gains
uh-huh.
when the economy shows employment losses because the employers, by definition, like us, who use commercial payroll systems
yeah.
have a different mindset from the employers who don't.
Correct. The employers who don't, I mean, just think of your typical construction company as it was run 10 years ago. It's changed a bit since then, but
they still use a lot of independent contractors that are really employees.
Yeah, there's still a lot of 1099s that go out for employment information instead of. So when we look at unemployment or when we look at GDP or when we look at most of the other numbers that are used to measure the economy, they are estimates. They get less rough estimates over time, but they're all estimates. And that tells you that it's kind of like your blood pressure. That's an estimate, too. Even though you've got a machine that tells you exactly what your blood pressure is, that number's going to change if you have your arm raised above your head or have it resting below your heart level. All of the numbers that we use to measure things change in different circumstances. So we try to make the measurements in the economy, to use that same blood pressure analysis, with the arm in exactly the same position every time. So when we use numbers like U6 and the economists kind of go, yeah, politicians will talk about the U6 number. Economists kind of go, oh, yeah.
Well, you know what
did they have their arm raised when the blood pressure was taken or lowered?
Do you know what the U stands for?
Is it unemployed?
No.
What is it?
Underutilization.
Oh, underutilization.
All of those
of
U
course.
Numbers.
I knew that at some point.
Are underutilization numbers.
I knew that at some point and then realized that that was such a silly word for it that I would just...
I just think it's neat.
Dump it.
Theoretically, you and I have been underutilized for many years.
Yeah, underutilization and negative growth are economic terms that are really silly. Negative growth to anyone other than an economist is shrinkage. But
now,
we would rather say negative growth.
The current one
mm-hmm.
that I find to be one of the greatest misnomers out there
uh-huh.
is disinflation.
Oh, yes. Disinflation. Disinflation seems to be...
We're not having deflation. We're having disinflation. In other words, we had inflation for a lot of years, so we're retracing it, and prices are going down. And dollars are more valuable, and if you have a loan, it's likely to hurt you really badly.
Right.
And you have negative interest rates in a lot of countries right now, and as a result, that's folks, that's deflation.
We already have a word for it. Don't make a new one.
Well, you got to make a new one because deflation is bad, so disinflation...
That sounds better.
You know what? Excuse me, I know you have a nail in your tire and you have disinflation.
See that man over there? He's disinflating your tire.
Well, you know, it's okay. I like that.
Deflate it.
Disinflation. We should.
But if it's been disinflated and you want to reinflate it, then you're un-disinflating a tire. See, you can just keep adding to the word.
Well, when you're dealing with trying to obfuscate. You like that word? When you're dealing with trying to obfuscate, the longer the word, the more efficient the word gets.
Right, and I think that's one of the issues there.
And if you have to look up obfuscate, look it up.
Yes.
Let's talk about what happened during the week, since forget to do that.
We also need to do our disclosure. No, put the clothes back. That's not what I meant.
Disclosure would mean disclothing.
Well, disclose means to open. We should just call it the opening, not of clothing.
Oh.
Yes, so it's a close with an S, not a TH.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Like old men in their zippers, yes.
Oh, boy. It's okay. Another symptom of being born in the wrong century.
Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the Personal Wealth Coach, discoincidentally.
Discoincidentally, yes.
Discoincidentally. That's a good term.
We could have an economics term named after us.
George W. Bush came up with some new words. You
right.
Know? Okay.
Strategery.
Strategery, yeah. Part of the strategery of the Personal Wealth Coach. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, which is not very well programmed, but is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. It happens to be a fee-only kind of fiduciary sort of firm that carries its registration with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. Not that they have particularly approved or disapproved,
because they don't do that.
It's kind of like Mission Impossible. The Secretary will neither approve nor disapprove.
Just because we're simply.
But that is our regulator. And the reason we say that is, so if you think that we're doing something that is fraudulent, dishonest, deceptive, or distasteful.
Any of the disses.
Yes. You can contact the United States Securities and Exchange Commission and complain, because that's our regulator.
And they will actually do something about it.
Maybe.
Hopefully.
If they have enough extra people than they think.
If it's a bad enough complaint.
Yeah. In other words, if you think we're doing something bad, you're welcome to complain to the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, because that's who regulates us. By the way, that means that we have more than $100 million under management. That's the definition of registering with the SEC versus registering with a state. If somebody has what are called small investment advisory firms, they register with a state, and that means they have less than $100 million under management. If you have over $100 million under management, then you register. And there's other complicated rules, but that's the basic ones. Anyway, so what happened during the week? We had 5 days this week, which is unlike next week. We'll only have 4 days in the week. The market days. That's all that we really count here. And what we saw was that the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1.41%. The S&P 500 dropped 0.81%. But that's not the whole story. On Thursday morning, the stock indices opened down vigorously.
It vigorously opened.
Vociferously. Violently.
I think we should call it disclosed in the morning and undisclosed in the evening.
I don't think so.
No.
I think they basically
they opened.
Headed down like mad. And I happened to be up, for reasons that I don't completely understand, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I had, because I consider the Wall Street Journal to be the funny pages, so I read it. And if you have to be my age to even know what the funny pages were. Anyway, so I opened up the Wall Street Journal, and what it said was European stocks down because following Asian stocks lowered.
Expect lowered in the U.S. economy.
No. It was the Asian stocks went down.
Which caused the European stocks to go down.
Which caused the European stocks. This is 3 o'clock in the morning, okay?
Right.
Now, and so the European stocks went down, particularly the banks. The banks sort of collapsed. And the reason kept being stated over and over again because Asian stocks were down. Because the Asian markets, which were closing at that point, which obviously opened up at a completely different time because they happened to be on the other side of the planet. And then as Wall Street opened up, as the East Coast opened up, the headline was
disclosed rather than open. It's not closed anymore. It's disclosed rather than open just because why not? We're economists.
Okay. I'm going to say open, though, because that's what it said in the paper.
Right. Okay. We'll say shrinkage instead of negative growth.
The paper that really wasn't paper, it's actually digital.
Right.
And what we heard, what the stories came out, and when it plunged and the reporters apparently wander around on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange and said, why is everybody selling? Well, because European stocks were down. Seriously.
So they must know something we don't know.
Yes, and so the whole issue was
they
on Thursday.
They know German and French,
right,
and Italian.
On Thursday morning, Asian stocks went down. Now, why did Asian stocks go down to begin with? Nobody's completely sure of that, but they went down.
I know why.
Why?
Because more people were trying to sell than were trying to buy.
Yeah, and I think there's some other deeper economic reasons for that. Basically, people were selling to get their money out of China.
Yes.
But so the stocks were down in Asia, which caused the people in the traders in Europe to say they must know something we don't know. So we're going to sell here in
Luxembourg and
in Europe,
France, and yes,
and we're going to take Deutsche Bank. By the way, they took Deutsche Bank's share price down to 1/3 of book value. In other words, if you take all that Deutsche Bank owes, all their liabilities, and all of their assets, that's their book value. And you balance them against each other, that's their book value. And the price of Deutsche Bank stock Thursday dropped to a level that was approximately 1/3 of the net assets of the bank. You got to admit that there's something fundamentally wrong there. But the point, this is the thing. When people are asked why, the people who were selling, they really didn't know for sure. They said something about negative interest rates, but that didn't make any sense if you think about it either. They did it because they did it. And then when the United States markets opened up, bank stocks fell like a rock, leading everything else down. Why? Well, because if European bank stocks are down, then obviously the Europeans know something we don't know. And if you actually ask the European traders, they were saying, well, Asian stocks were down, and they obviously know something we don't know. And if you went over to Asia and they said, why were you guys selling? Well, we thought that Donald Trump, and Lem literally, when I trace this down, they figured out in Asia that Trump and Sanders won in New Hampshire. Now, I'm serious. So the reason we had a stock market plunge on Thursday
was because
the Asian people who have no concept, I mean, Chinese, they have no concept of the way our political system works.
Not at all.
But they do know that both Donald Trump and what's Sanders' first name?
Bernie.
I keep wanting to call him Barry. Sanders.
That's the other president.
Yes.
Guy.
Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both have said if they're elected president, they will repudiate all the free trade agreements and treaties and throw up a huge economic blockade against China and Japan, which would start a trade war, which would devastate both economies. And what happened was the Chinese, Japanese, Indonesian, et cetera, traders suddenly realized the two people who just won the first official election leading up to the presidential election in the United States have both said they want to wage economic war on everybody in Asia.
Right.
And so the stocks went down, which caused hours later, the U.S. stock market to collapse.
Because the Asians must know something, because the Europeans must know something,
They did know something we don't know, which is that
they don't know what we know.
No. Yeah.
Yes. So this is why the markets are not predictable, because there are so many people out there ignorant of what other people are not ignorant of, and vice versa, who assume that other people must know something they don't know. The reality is most people are just ignorant.
Now, here's the interesting thing. In the middle of the day, the S&P 500 hit 1813.
It's a good year.
It hit a low of 1813 and promptly started up. And it started up the last hour or so of trading on Thursday. It kept going up pretty much all day on Friday, so it rose 3% in just over a day. To over 2% of that was just on Friday. Now, why is that significant? Well, among other things, the short sellers, now that's the people who sell stock they don't own, and there's a lot of them.
Or sell stock that they own, but they don't sell the stock that they own. They're selling somebody else's stock
so that they
can come in and sell their other stock that they do own at another time.
You're getting complicated. Basically, they sell stock they borrowed.
Right.
And that forces the market down. Now, and the intent is when that stock gets down to the point, and by the way, you can sell actually contracts that you don't own on the S&P 500. So you can sell the whole S&P 500, short sell it. And when it hits a point where you think, I don't think it's going to go any lower, then you buy it back, which causes the market to rise. And apparently, the short seller buybacks were what happened starting on Thursday and into Friday. The volume, I just saw the analysis this morning. Apparently, the sudden rise in the stock market was the short sellers, the pessimists, the bears, concluded on Thursday and Friday, this is about as low as it's going to go. Now, I hope they're right. If the bears think this is as low as it's going to go, that could have been a good signal. No guarantees, but in the craziness, the short-term craziness of the market. What did you say? I think we've used this quote before. It's in the short term, the stock market is a casino.
Yeah.
And in the long term, it's an investment.
Right.
And that's certainly what happened out there. Now, what's the bigger story?
Let me throw in another piece here. Another reason why the Asian markets and then the European markets and the American markets have been all squirrely is because of oil. No, that's a very common excuse used lately. The oil's doing this, therefore that's a good reason. And you can basically say oil's going up or oil's going down, and that causes the market to go up or down equally likely. It really isn't caused by oil, but that's a big thing people are talking about. I want to really address this piece.
But you're not in Gettysburg.
No, it's a different kind of address.
Okay.
My address is Austin and soon to be Salado, so it's not that kind of address.
But you're in Temple right now, so it'd be the Temple address.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so this is the Temple address. There have been a lot of people writing about how the drop in the price of oil is devastating the economy. You addressed this specifically in our email that was sent out last night, but you didn't address the other pundits that are out there, these people that have written these great stories.
I don't know their addresses.
No, we've got to figure out their addresses.
Right.
One of the major news pieces that was out talked about the cost to the economy in the drop in the oil prices has been more than $3 trillion with a T, because the companies that would be getting that extra money for having it up at $100+ a barrel aren't getting that money, and so $3 trillion disappeared out of the economy. And that's basically the premise for the whole thing and why it is that we should immediately have recessions and so on. There's a problem with that number, and it's a major problem. $3 trillion didn't disappear out of the economy, it just didn't transfer from one group of people to another group of people. If people don't pay back their loans, that causes money to disappear out of the economy. If people buy a computer on sale rather than buying it at full price, that doesn't cause money to disappear out of their own bank account. The money's still there. That's the point I'm making here, that what happens with oil or any other commodity, when commodity prices drop, short term people panic because they don't know what's going to happen. Long term, it's really good for the economy.
So we should get rid of short term people.
Yes. Yes. Get rid of all the short term people.
The tall term people are okay.
Yeah, tall term is fine.
Right.
When we're talking about recessions, so people are using oil prices as a reason why we must be hitting recessions, because if you look back at all these recessions in the past, oil prices drop during a recession, so we must be in a recession. That's what they're saying. The reason why the oil prices drop in recession is because less people are traveling. You're buying less oil to do things. You've got less manufacturing going on. You've got less transportation going on. You've got less shipping of goods going on. So the demand is down, and that causes the oil prices to drop. In this case, it's the other end of the supply-demand area. We've got more people buying oil. There's more traveling being done. If we could measure the amount of traveling taking place, the amount of transport taking place better, it's very clear, the little amount of measurement that we can do, that more is taking place, not less, which historically would cause the price of oil to go up, except that we found a lot of better ways of getting oil, which means that the supply is bigger. If you use the price of oil and say, historically, the price of oil drops because of recessions, that's true, but it also drops when we have a lot of oil all of the sudden.
Not sudden. Right. And there's you said something that I wanted to bring up. But you didn't know you said it.
I didn't know I said it. Yes. You're right. I think I knew I said it. I just didn't know that you wanted to bring it up.
See, that's brilliant. There is a thing out there, a thing called a theory.
A theory.
It's actually an hypothesis but it's still called a theory. It's called Dow theory. It should be the Dow hypothesis, but that's got too many syllables in it, so people don't want to say it. The Dow theory is that the transports lead the market. The transportation index leads the market.
Right. That's
one of the precepts of the Dow theory. And guess what has been rising since January 15th?
The Dow transport.
Dow Jones Transportation Index rises even while the rest of the market has been falling.
Well, it makes sense because their major expense is oil and gas, and that price has been going down. So their profits are going way up.
And but the point is, their profits couldn't go up unless they were hauling a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And we have a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, you were talking about the Deutsche Bank thing a few minutes ago. There mm-hmm. was a thing in the Wall Street about, a warning signal flashes, credit default swaps, and that's somehow people are concerned about strength of banks, and I guess credit default swaps are going up or whatever. Can you explain a little bit about what those are and if they're legitimate or is it just emotionalism? Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Yes, we can.
I think we can.
All right. Credit default swaps are kind of like co-insurance. Basically, what it says is that if I can't pay my debt, I have paid some money in insurance for someone else to step in and pay my debt. Now, they don't want to give me that insurance unless I can prove that I can pay my debt, which is like getting a loan these days. You can't really get a loan unless you don't need the loan. And you can't get a credit default swap very easily without paying a lot of money for it unless you don't need it. So credit default swap just says, okay, credit is a loan. Default means inability to pay that loan. Swap means I'm going to sell or buy from someone else the ability to save me from defaulting on my credit. So that's about it's a four-letter word in a lot of people's mind, even though there's a lot more letters in the words.
Basically, a credit default swap says let's say I buy a bond from I don't know, General Motors.
Right. That's a good one.
Or better yet, from the Killeen Independent School District
okay,
or something like
that's
that.
That's good.
Okay, I buy a bond. And I say, now what happens if Fort Hood shuts down and KISD defaults? Now, by the way, I don't think that...
That's high likelihood. Yeah.
Because the state of Texas effectively says, no, we'll cover it. But let's just say I was concerned about that and I wanted to buy insurance. By the way, you can get credit default swap insurance dirt cheap on something that the state of Texas guarantees.
Right, because they say, "Yes, I will never need to do this, but you can pay me for it anyway."
You can go out onto the market and there's a market, there is actually an exchange for credit default swaps, which is like the bond exchange. It's made up of a bunch of individual brokers.
This is what they call a derivative, by the way.
And you go out and you buy credit insurance on the bond, and there's a price for it. And it's not going to be very much because if you're buying a bond backed by, at least theoretically, no one's ever tested this, by the full faith and credit of the state of Texas, since Texas has a balanced budget law.
And a big rainy day fund.
You know, yeah. So it's not going to cost you very much. And, of course, the reason credit default swaps on bank securities are a big deal is because they were the key to the collapse that nobody saw coming.
2007, 2008.
Yeah, and what happened is AIG was the biggest issuer of credit default swaps in the world. And
they were issuing credit default swaps on
right.
really, really bad packages of mortgages.
But they didn't know that. They
but
were
they
AAA
know.
Rated. They,
right.
they basically had a little office in London that issued credit default. They basically sold dirt cheap insurance on AAA rated mortgage bonds all over the world. And
what they didn't know is those AAA rated bonds were AAA because there was credit default swaps already in them from other places.
Well, actually, those A's all stood for awful.
Awful, awful. Yes. They mixed in at the beginning.
They thought they were awesome, but they were actually awful.
Right. At the beginning, the AAAs were AAA because the people who got the loans to pay for their houses could afford to pay for their houses. And over time, they started mixing in people who had mortgage insurance because the insurance would pay if they defaulted. So that's still AAA, right? Oh, yeah, that's fine. But you can't put in the whole amount of that. And then they'd mix more into that. And it gets a little complicated how they mixed it in. They basically repackaged already packaged products and spread it all around so that the majority of what was out there was AAA only because of the credit default swaps in them, which is not a good thing. And then they issued more credit default swaps on top on the new packages. So this is why credit default swaps have had a really bad name. But it's also why the people issuing them today are very careful about how they issue them because they just had to eat their hats and all kinds of other bad things in the process.
And there's a bunch of fines that run from the tens of millions to literally the hundreds of millions of dollars being levied against major Wall Street banks and international banks, including Deutsche Bank, right now by the federal regulatory agencies in the United States because they went crazy over mortgage leverage derivatives and did not reveal the risks. While at the same time, those same regulators are looking over the shoulders very carefully of these bankers to make sure they don't repeat that mistake.
Right.
They have the Dodd-Frank. Is it Dodd? Yeah, anyway,
Dodd-Frank was one of the major ones.
They have the Dodd-Frank law, which a lot of people don't like, the banks don't like, but I think is probably very, very valid, where the Federal Reserve and can look over their shoulders and say, no, you can't do that. They can't take the level of risk that they were taking before. So basically, the markets and the credit default swap numbers that you were talking about are composed of a couple of things. Number one, there's a bunch of people who are scared. They think, oh, no, I don't care what the bankers say. They haven't learned anything. I don't care what the regulators say. We're going to do the same thing. We're about to do the same thing here we did in 2008. And by the way, I even got a message from a guy who is a speculator who said this is shaping up to be worse than 2008. He's wrong, in my opinion.
Right.
But it is an indicator. I've had a number of people who are scared and who see all the patterns of 2008 in their mind. And so it's kind of like generals who are fighting the last war. They generally lose. The point is that the thing that happened in 2008 and 2009 is the least, in my opinion, the least likely thing to happen today because everybody's scared of it.
Right. And this all stems, Deutsche Bank was the thing. They've just posted the first quarterly loss since 2008, and everybody knows what was going on in 2008. The quarterly loss that they posted, to some extent, had to do with the paying on credit default swaps because Germany is an exporter. They are a mega exporter, a huge portion of their economy. What did you say, 46% of their economy?
46% of the GDP of Germany is based on exports.
And exports are down. Exports are down because they were exporting a lot of stuff to China. Now, exports will come back. That's not a question. The fact that the dollar is rising and the Chinese yuan is still linked to the dollar means that they can buy things from Germany really well, but they're not buying as much because they don't export as much because the dollar makes the yuan more valuable, and so their prices are too high. So they can buy things from Germany at a lower price, but then they still have to sell it at a higher price. That's foreign exchange irregularities going on there. But Germany is feeling it because with the last year, the euro was really, really strong. It's come way down. What can we expect from that? Well, Germany's going to have a recovery this year. Germany's going to have a recovery this year, and everybody's going to say, Angela Merkel did a great job or whatever. The reason why I say they're going to have a recovery this year is because they're an export economy. And the euro is going down in value based on the dollar. The dollar is much higher than the euro. The euro trades now somewhere around $1.07, $1.08. At its peak, it was like $1.55, which means it's cheaper to buy German products in the United States and in China and most other places that have some link to the dollar. And we've got some commercials we have to play.
Whoa, yeah, we got to do some commercials. There's a lot of things.
A lot of things
to talk about. This has been
been an eventful year so far.
Economically, it's been a very busy week, and there's a lot of stuff going on out there. But for better or worse, we need to do commercials to keep KTEM on the air and us not paying for the show. So we'll be back on the other side of these important commercial announcements from KTEM and Town Square Media.